morning and welcome to our meeting this morning with National Treasury colleagues, Minister, and your team. Thank you very much. Minister is coming back today. The meeting will also back to back with the same slot. And you will recall, colleagues, we had scheduled further today, but you asked National Treasury to come in. So at some point, the minister will take leave of us, but the team remains. And the meeting is pretty straightforward as well. The update on Treasury Instruction Note 4 of 2223 regarding the exemption of state owned entities from reporting during the expenditure. We'll recall that yesterday we had Transnet, and they made a lot of fun and dance about the own exemption, which ends in March 2024. It was a similar matter with Eskom. We thought, let's deal with this matter, unpack it and understand it, so that we are able to oversight correctly and be able to have a keen and full understanding of National Treasury's thinking and rationale insofar as this exemption is concerned. So it's just that straightforward presentation. I think because we've got load shedding at 10, let's dive right into it. So colleagues, good morning and welcome. Happy Wednesday. Minister, over to you.
As you, honourable members, as you correctly said, Chair, it is a fairly straightforward matter which is not a technical issue with the team in our class. But I must say, in respect of ESCOM, you guys beat me up on the procedure with the exemption, so ESCOM will be out of the equation. Whatever had of it was harsh on me, and if I'm not my colleague from the same country. So I had to withdraw the ESCOM. But interesting enough, it was after, you probably didn't see the Transnet one and nobody saw it at that.
Knock it through.
Like you had allowed the team to.
You came back on steroids with all the things you got.
The opportunity. Thanks, Richard.
Good morning, honorable chairperson, members of the standing committee, joint account, colleagues. As requested by the invitation, the request is really to provide proper an update on Treasury Instruction 4 regarding the exemption of state-owned entities from reporting irregular expenditure. As the chair indicated in his introduction, there were oversight meetings which were and I think that is part of the topical area, and it has also received a number of media inquiries. So I think it's quite important we also clarify some of the technical aspects of instruction 4. Moving on into the presentation on slide 3.
We're not slide yet because it's pointless at 10 o'clock at all. So all members have got a soft copy, a hard copy. Colleagues, you all got hard copies, right? Yeah, they're open, so don't worry, we deliberately not bothering with this.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. So, in response to the brief, we've put together the slides into three parts. Part A would present or outline the following categories of the legislative requirements around the PFMA, the Treasury Regulation, the intention of instruction 4, and really providing a conclusion on the actual brief. We further move into part B, really unpacking the intention and the purpose of instruction 4. And part C is really some of the current challenges which you will have seen with the Transnet briefing and some of the legislative reforms with the team, which we will also unpack as part of our presentation. So moving straight to part A, on to slide 5, which is the requirements of the PSMA. And really, the PSMA requires accounting officers and accounting authorities in relation to unauthorized, irregular, and fraudulent racial expenditure to implement the necessary controls. So we see section 38, there's a number of preventative controls which the law is very clear. Accounting officers and accounting authorities must proactively prevent irregular expenditure. With regard to detective control, the PSMA unpacks on discovery of any transactions that may be irregular, what are the reporting requirements. Furthermore, it unpacks the areas of consequence management with regard to appropriate disciplinary action in the event that there is irregular expenditure, unauthorized and fraudulent racial expenditure. Furthermore, the reporting requirements are in section 43B and section 35.2B of the PSMA, and this is really the crux of why we are here today and to unpack that. Moving on to slide 6, section 40 subsection 3B and section 55 subsection 2B of the PSMA provides for the annual report and the financial statements of institutions subject to the PSMA, should include particulars of any unauthorized expenditure in the case of departments, irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, any criminal or disciplinary steps taken as a result of such lawsuit, and unauthorized, irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, any material losses recovered, and any other methods that may be prescribed under the PSMA. Moving on to the requirements of the Treasury Regulation, accounting officers are required in terms of Treasury Regulation 9.1.5 to disclose as a note to the annual financial statement amounts of unauthorized, irregular, and fraudulent and wasteful expenditure. Accounting authorities are also required in terms of Treasury Regulation 28.2.1 to disclose as a note to the annual financial statement any material losses through criminal conduct and any irregular and fraudulent and wasteful expenditure. So broadly, that's the requirements of the PSMA and the Treasury Regulation. Moving on into slide 8, which is really the purpose of what Instruction Note 4 was trying to do. And Instruction Note 4 introduced a compliance and reporting framework, and the purpose of it is really to prescribe principles and compliance reporting requirements, application, implementation, and reporting of unauthorized, irregular, fraudulent and wasteful expenditure, reporting on payments of supplier invoices, that's where the compliance, other compliance areas come in. Reporting on supply chain management information related to procurement by other means, contract variations and expansions. More importantly, it is to document and disclose information related to regulatory and legal requirements in the annual report. Introducing such an instruction, it's important that we secure transparency and accountability of processes related to unauthorized, irregular, and fraudulent and wasteful expenditure. Moving on to slide 9, this instruction note was issued in terms of section 76 of the PSMA, and it applies to all institutions subject to the PSMA. The effective date was January 2023. And as from the 2022-2023 financial year, the annual report will include a dedicated section on compliance as required by Instruction 4. So as COPA also does its oversight, there will be in annual reports of departments this new area or new section on compliance.
slide 10 really concludes on the brief, very briefly, but instruction note 4 does not exempt SOE or any other institution from reporting on irregular expenditure. It aligns to the reporting requirements captured in section 40 and 55 of the PFMA for all institutions to report on unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure occurred during that financial year. It must be further noted that exemptions from reporting on irregular expenditure can only be considered under section 92 of the PFMA, and that's the one which Transnet was granted an exemption on. Moving into part B of the presentation, and here we unpack really the objectives and the principles around instruction 4. So moving on to slide 12, the objectives of instruction 4 is captured there. It provides the standards to be applied and reporting process to be followed by accounting officers, accounting authorities, and for accounting officers and accounting authorities when reporting on matters related to supply chain management processes, and for accounting officers and accounting authorities when reporting on matters related to late payment of suppliers. Late payment of suppliers is a compliance area but will not be covered as part of this presentation this morning. On slide 13, here we unpack what happens on the discovery of any irregular expenditure transaction. An employee who becomes aware or suspects the occurrence of unauthorized, irregular, or fruitless and wasteful expenditure must inform Treasury Regulation 9.1.2 immediately in terms of the internal policies of agencies in writing report such expenditure to the accounting officer or to the accounting authority or to a duly delegated official. In terms of the recognition of the expenditure, which is the accounting for it, the expenditure incurred in contravention of or not in accordance with the legislation is regarded as irregular expenditure, and such expenditure is recognized in the statement of financial performance, or rather known as the income statement, or in terms of accrual accounting where a liability is recognized in the statement of financial position. On slide 14, we unpack or outline the reporting of irregular expenditure in the annual financial statement. And here instruction note 4 goes into the detail. Irregular expenditure when incurred and confirmed is disclosed in the annual financial statements. Amounts disclosed in the annual financial statements relate to irregular expenditure incurred in the current year. Were a one financial year comparative in accordance with the accounting principles. Irregular expenditure for the previous financial years or where they are comparative amounts must be recognized in the period in which they are in which they occurred as follows. Irregular expenditure incurred and confirmed in the previous financial year. Irregular expenditure that was under assessment in the previous financial year and confirmed in the current financial year. Irregular expenditure that was not discovered in the previous financial year and identified and confirmed in the current financial year. Lastly, irregular expenditure, payments relating to multi-year contracts that was not condoned or addressed. Slide 15 outlines the reporting requirements of irregular expenditure, unauthorized and fruitless and wasteful expenditure in the annual report. And here, the requirements are that information related to irregular expenditure, one must outline the assessment that was conducted, the determination test, any investigation in instances where there is fraud or corruption, a reconciliation of historical irregular expenditure, and other important narratives such as consequence management and inter-institutional arrangements must be recorded in the annual report in accordance with the prescribed reporting requirements. Slide 16 gives a broad outline of what the annual report is, and I'm sure members of SCOPA would be familiar with the different sections of the annual report, and really the one instruction note for that is introduce a new section called compliance information, and that's where all the compliance aspects will be reported in. Slide 17 is just the quarterly reporting that's required to the relevant treasury as set out in the framework, and the reporting includes unauthorized and prohibited expenditure as well, and that is just a snapshot of what the quarterly report reporting will look like. Slide 18 provides a graphical illustration of the different steps in terms of the discovery and identification of irregular expenditure. And the assessment process is really to confirm whether there is irregular transaction. The determination test looks at or confirms the root causes, the financial losses, whether the transaction is fraudulent, corrupt, or there is criminal action, officials responsible, and any internal controls deficiencies. Investigations will look into the impact of the financial law, reporting elements of fraudulent, corrupt, and criminal acts to SABA. Slide 19 outlines the condemnation process. And the condemnation process is really once a transaction is regarded as irregular, it needs to follow a process to be condoned. In that process, in order for the transaction to be condoned, there must be confirmation that a determination test was conducted. The findings and recommendations of the loss control function or any other relevant function that conducted the determination test. Confirmation that the matter is free of fraud, corruption, or any other criminal conduct. If the matter has fraudulent, corrupt, or other criminal conduct, confirmation of the case number showing that a case was opened for the Braxton Police Services. Confirmation that no loss was incurred and that value for money was achieved. Confirmation that disciplinary action was taken or in the process of being taken against the responsible official. And lastly, confirmation of remedial actions taken or being taken by the accounting officer or the accounting authority to prevent the recurrence of irregular expenditure in similar circumstances. Slide 20 outlines areas of consequence management, and here we unpack the requirements of Treasury Regulation 33.3.1, which requires the accounting authority to submit to the executive authority the relevant Treasury and Auditor General on an annual basis a schedule of the outcome of any disciplinary hearing or criminal charges, the name and rank of employees involved, and the sanctions and any further sanctions taken against these employees. This is information is reported in the annual report of AFC. Furthermore, the National Treasury, together with the DPSA, DPME, and DCorp, has put together a centralized register to track employees that resign before investigation for disciplinary action has been taken. And this central register will provide specific information that will, among others, assist organs of state to strengthen their administrative capacity for vetting of new and existing employees in the public service, and enable for detective and preventative mechanisms. Lastly, moving into part C of the presentation, and we're almost towards the end. Here we unpack some of the governance, operational, and accountability challenges. And I'm sure sure Franz Nehmer also has outlined to the committee around the onerous reporting requirements for SOEs, in addition to the international financial reporting standards requirements, compliance to the PFMA, as well as JFE debt listing requirements. And here we've seen the impact of audit qualifications on the ability of SOEs to raise capital in the open market. We've also seen that SOEs have experienced some challenges, especially in policy and mandate misalignment, inefficient operations, and failure to keep pace with changes in the industry. Governance failings, weak balance sheets, and poor financial performance, which really impacts SOEs to refinance their existing debt, which leads to liquidity risk, inadequate mechanisms to enforce accountability. We've also seen a growing number of SOEs with recurring qualifications relating to the completeness of irregular purposes of wasteful expenditure reported in annual financial statements. SOEs struggling with systems and capacity to uncover and report all irregular expenditure, and this is really the completeness test for the reporting of irregular expenditure. And these recurring qualifier for the opinions affect how SOEs compete in the open market. Slide 23 really outlines some of the broader reforms which the National Treasury is undertaking. It's really looking to see how to improve the reporting of unauthorized, irregular and fluctuating wasteful expenditure in government. The Minister of Finance in his budget speech in February 2022 said, "We must differentiate between corruption and minor transgressions of the rules of policy prescripts that are audited as irregular expenditure. The National Treasury is engaging with the Auditor General to continue to ensure transparent disclosure of minor transgressions, but outside the financial audit process. Furthermore, President Ramaphosa, in his response to the State Capture Report, indicates the following. The National Treasury and the Auditor General of Africa are working together to review the usefulness of the concept of irregular expenditure and to focus on identifying corrupt or suspicious expenditure or expenditure made in bad faith. This is part of an effort to address the Commission's recommendation cited in paragraph 5.3.2.3. Slide 24 and 25 really looked at some of the legislative reform areas, and really the key principal intention is to go back to the original intention of the PFMA, which was really to let managers manage, but they must be accountable. We're looking at strengthening reporting and consequence management frameworks for SOEs. SOEs responsible for developing and implementing sound internal control environment, including risk management, internal control systems to identify non-compliance, fraud, corruption, and criminal intent. And this is really what the PFMA envisaged, that the accounting authorities, the boards overseeing these SOEs, would ensure that these systems of internal control are in place. So this then begs the question that why did the audit committees and internal control fail for so many years, in which we have seen corrupt and criminal activity. We're also looking at reducing the number of instruction notes made applicable to SOEs, which allows them to operate in a commercially environment and to be competitive in the market. In terms of the combined assurance model on slide 25, internal audit mandate is to conduct risk-based audit approach in the SOEs. this is really a sounding board for all organizations. They either need to intensify risk management systems to identify areas of fraud, corruption, or criminal intent. And lastly, for the audit committees to interrogate these reports and demand management responses on how these issues are being addressed. Slide 26 really is a vice the link from which these instruction notes can be located or can be accessed by the committee. Chair, on that note, I'd like to then end my report and my apologies. I forgot to introduce my very capable colleague on my left, Ms. Moiponi Ramaponi, who is the Chief Director of focusing this area of work. Thank you so much.
Put your set of questions, get the spot on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the Minister made a comment earlier about someone on this committee being the same political party, but having listened to the Minister's comments about Kay's deployment, I would have thought he was a member of my party. hello, Cindy. Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite convinced about this instruction note 4. I'm just wondering, let's put the section 92 issue aside, because I think that needs some interrogation as well in terms of the content example. But the slide 22, this, I think, if I'm correct, the mischief that the note 4 is trying to fix. Am I right about that? Is slide 22 detail the mischief that's being looked at to fix?
That's part of the border reform process.
Just look at your slide 22. It says the government operation accountability challenges. So is note 4 intended to fix those challenges?
Note 4 doesn't address the currency, but these are part of the broader legislative report. You have to look at some of these areas.
You get a tick for that because Note 4 cannot deal with these things. And so my question then is, what is the mischief that Note 4 is dealing with if it's simply a different way of reporting in the annual statement? And why was there a need to issue note 4? This the strange committee. We ask a question, get an immediate reply, and then is that okay with you?
No. I won't interrupt the conversation and listen to each other.
Thank you, Chair. Note 4 introduced a compliance framework. And the compliance regulatory regime appears to be quite broad. What it wanted to do is it wanted to align the requirements of the PFMA and the Treasury regulation, specifically around the reporting of irregular expenditure, to instruction reports. So they wanted to ensure that there was complete alignment. That was the first thing. The second thing was it brought other compliance areas like payments not made within 30 days, any other supply chain management issues where there's no compliance, expansion of deviation, and those were the compliance aspects that we thought would enhance the accountability regime from an oversight perspective. So instruction note 4 really introduced a compliance report as part of the annual report.
That's the way I'm beginning to understand it, and thank you. I think that's not a bad thing. I don't know if it's a good thing, but it's certainly not a bad thing. And so challenges or the mischief that are listed on 22, about 22 at all. In fact, it makes those challenges even bigger because there you go.
There we go.
See, and Eskim, you wanted to grant them exemption. it's a different kind of motivation from dealing with a problem. It's just making it stronger, and that seems to me to be a good motivation. So, Mr. Chairman, so the note 4 to me doesn't seem to be the real issue here. It's the use of section 92 which seems to be the issue, and the minister graciously accepted the pressure from my colleague, who he claims is his colleague, caused that one to be reversed. So, but others have gone ahead, and so that really, I think, Mr. Chairman, is where we should be focused, rather than on this presentation, which I think, after hearing, I can't say that I can disagree with material way, but I can disagree with the use of section 92, which you haven't explained to how that is not given National Treasury the authority to exempt Transnet, and what other entities perhaps we should be told about section 92 and how it's been used, and which entities have been exempted, other than it. Who's going to answer that?
Chair, I can probably take a step. Use the software voice.
Will it be a software voice this time, a rally voice this
time? The section 92 potentially is really what we saw and unpacked in the ESCOM section. Go to some of the oversight committees including the scope of, and in this space we did have Transnet accepting exemption, and the exemption for Transnet was really around the reporting of irregular expenditure in the annual financial statement. And I think this is where the confusion lies between the structure note 4 and section 92. That exemption under section 92 provided an exemption for Transnet from reporting irregular expenditure in the financial statements. Instruction note 4 still requires irregular expenditure that occurred in a particular financial year together with a comparative to still be reported, so it doesn't provide any exemption for the reporting of irregular expenditure. We do get a number of requests for exemption. Some of it is an exemption from particular sections of the PMA. I'm just trying to think of an example of it, but my colleague may be able to remind me of one. But we did get one from an organization recently, and Minister, with your permission, there was a letter. It was government printing works. Just use that as an example so that you understand the type of request. Government printing works lost data or lost information in their system, and they receive a disclaimer of opinion from the Auditor General because of their inability to produce accurate financial statements. They applied to the Minister of Finance for an exemption, an exemption from preparing certain sections of what we consider a complete set of financial reports. They wanted an exemption from reporting on certain disclosure notes, certain sections of the statement of financial position, which is the balance sheet, some exemptions from the income statement as well. And when you consider that, we still need to consider the key principles of the PFM around accountability and transparency. And in considering exemptions in general, if there's any deviation from those two principles, then as the Treasury and the Minister of Finance's
his position to us was very clear that we can't consider it. That request then was denied. We do time and again get requests for exemption, but most often than not, it's actually denied on the basis that it won't achieve the transparency that we are seeking in the financial statements. Obviously, the ESCOM and the Transnet ones have different reasons, and there's a key element which the team looked at is the fiscal risk in the event that that there were defaults and some of the lenders then recalled some of those loans. And that was fundamentally the key reason why the minister then considered those two exemptions. But in principle, that's how we would then look at exemptions under Section 92 of the PSMA.
I'm going towards my microphone, which doesn't work. Force of habit. Again, it seems to me that the contents of slide 22 can't be fixed with an exemption even under Section 92. Because the for instance the misalignment, inefficient operations, all that sort of stuff can't be fixed by a stroke of a pen by the Minister of Finance. But what it does do is it hides it from institutions who may withdraw support, whether it's international finance houses or whatever. And I would find that somewhat unacceptable, given if I was one of those institutions and I found out later that the things were, I would be very reticent about financing anything in the country that was aligned with the state. And I think the risk is much greater by hiding things, because effectively that's what exemptions under Section 92, and I'm pleased to hear that the Minister is very cautious about issuing those. I mean, the next thing is entities like the printer, government printer, will deliberately lose this stuff and say, well, we can't report, please give us an exemption. You know, the risks are very high. So, Mr. Chairman, let me go back. The instruction note 4, I think, makes it even more onerous to report, and I don't see at this stage, I haven't studied it terribly closely, a big issue there. But instruction or use of Section 92 remains a problem. And so if the motivation is, as you say, for, and ESCOM was then withdrawn correctly, Mr. Minister, I think, why is Transnet still in place? Why is it not being withdrawn from Transnet? What is the difference?
We, during the ESCOM consultation, when the Minister withdrew the exemption and requested that there must be a period of consultation, we've engaged a number of investors, rating agencies, including the auditors of those institutions, as well as the Auditor General. And during those consultations, what was quite clear, in the most profound one, was the ratings agency. And the whole concept of irregular expenditure is quite unique in the South African context. Other jurisdictions don't have concepts like irregular expenditure. They report on losses, that a lot of public funds. And that is really the key what other jurisdictions are looking for and what the rating agencies also advise is that if National Treasury can find a way of ring-fencing this so that it doesn't create unnecessary anxiety outside the market, Because generally when people say a qualified audit opinion, immediately it does, there are defaults in some of the debt covenants, and they've actually requested that we need consider this. The concept of irregular expenditure, and you see also in how the Auditor General now reports their material irregularity, is that not all irregular irregular expenditure transactions are lawful. In most cases, you do get value for money. There is a small non-compliance part of the bigger process. Where the focus is, or where the focus has to be going forward, is on losses. And even when the Auditor General introduced the concept of material irregularity, they looked at, number one, there must be a non-compliance, which means there's a transgression. But then they also looked at, is there a law? If there's no loss to the state, they didn't pursue it as a material irregularity. And that loss is quite important for us to then consider. What we were very concerned, especially in the ESCOM example, was the losses that we know that have been reported in prior years. And if you look at ESCOM's annual report, they have losses from a number of the coal contracts, from diesel, and those ones there, we saw it as quite important for that still to be reported. So even if the minister and we were able to twist his arm to grant an exemption, that part of it there, he was quite clear he wasn't going to provide an exemption. In Transnet's case, Minister, this is a difficult one, but Transnet one is, there was a full year after the exemption was provided or approved. And immediately what we saw was that there was a change in the audit outcome, number one. Number two is we requested plans from Transnet on some of the remedial actions on how they were to turn the table in terms of managing this area. And what this has allowed is that for Transnet, the space to actually go and deal with some of the irregular transactions in the environment. More importantly, what it did also is that a number of the lenders keep on knocking on the door when there's a qualification, and they have to then request exemption from those lenders in the same because they either default when there's a qualification. This is giving them the breathing space. There have been engagements between the Treasury team, and in fact the Auditor General as well, and the Transnet. And what I can say is that we are paying very close attention to Transnet. We are engaging them on a continuous basis. More importantly, giving them the time to ensure that they actually fix the problem of in their supply chain management. And that's really why the Transnet extension is doing so.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'm fairly determined. And you said yourself when you started at Transnet, this is a difficult one. I can't quite see a significant difference in the status of losses in Transnet from those in Gaston. The quantums may be different, although I think they probably are not, given the capital investment in locos that are stuck all over the world, and we're trying to unlock SARS and the Reserve Bank. And so in giving them space and you working very closely with them, at the same time, blocking oversight from this committee in particular, but any is I think not the right way to go. If the lenders are being problematic with Transnet, I don't understand why they're not being problematic with it. And we know that Transnet nearly defaulted on their $1 payment in July last year. So, Mr. Chairman, I remain unconvinced I've been a fan of National Treasury for a very long time, as most of you know. But at the same time, I don't place National Treasury in a better position to do the oversight than this committee. Because essentially that's what you're saying to us. We are working with Transnet and the Auditor General. We are monitoring it. We are working closely with them. And just relax. We'll make sure it goes well. Essentially, that's the message I'm getting. I'm sorry if it's a bit blunt, but that's the message I'm getting. And whilst I repeat, I have a great deal of respect for National Treasury. Because they held the line during some really, really traumatic years in this country. And I have to give you due for that. But in this instance, Mr. Chairman, I reserve my judgment is not out. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe let's pick up the issue of oversight and hiding the things from the committee. I don't think that's intention. He has a challenge for National Treasury. It's fiscal exposure. When you say why they're not raising anything with ESCOM, especially because we have to deal with the fiscal exposure. By providing small grants to
data.
This year alone we've been giving ESCOM 7-8 million, and I don't have that money. So I guess the conversation we should have with the committee, which we're willing to do, is how do we manage the reporting requirements of the state-owned enterprises to be in line with the International Financial Fund, so that they be, when they raise money in whether it's in the stock exchange, they are basically on an equal footing with private sector companies. That's the first discussion. The second discussion we need then to have, how do we manage in such a manner that we keep an eye on the irregular and the expenditure in such a manner that the committee has portfolio. I think that's a conversation we should have. From where we sit as National Treasurer, in fact, it worked in our favor to have these things in full view and committees, parliament. There's limitation in how far we can go as National Treasurer to oversee my colleagues. There's limitation to those. So it works in our favor that the committee of parliament exercise that oversight. So what probably as part of the legislative reform is a conversation we need to be having with parliament. We, from where we sit, would like parliament to have that full view as moving forward. I mean, given the printing works thing was precisely because of the problem that you're going to be, we're trying to say, okay, this is accidental, and there's absolute difficult for them to say they will ever get this information back. But precisely for the same reason, I realize, how far can we stretch the envelope? If everybody comes back to us and says, because the point of raising, okay, the information is lost, write a paper of course an exemption. Of course, I can apply it. I'm saying, let's have a conversation for now. The regulatory framework says they must disclose in the financial system, everything. But as part of the regulatory framework moving forward, let's have a conversation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I put two hands up.
Now
I'm
second.
Take on the hand, and we'll wrap it up.
Okay, next line. Allow the paper.
Before she fights you.
Yeah, before we fight you.
Okay. Bulele check. Noche, I want to pick it up from their response on the meaning. And which actually is trying to give me kind of comfort, because one, if you read what is on the slide 22 and for the TFMA compliance and reporting framework, we are in a sense circumventing the law. But when you are now saying Parliament must thoroughly engage and develop a legislation, then I let's not circumvent the law. Let's allow the people to follow the existing law. Let me make an example before I pose the question. When there was an attempt to exempt ESCOM, which you successfully withdrew after considering the loophole of implementation, it was not going to serve any people for ESCOM, because there was already a declaration that they can't borrow. They are not allowed to be borrowing and all of those things. But the worry of recurring outcomes, qualified outcomes of audit, is not making them to be in competition where markets and lending is concerned. Does not arise. But then, when you apply that rule against a Transnet, which Mazambane was talking about, what it does, it says, be incompetent, do whatever you do, incur the irregular expenditure, the following year is going to disappear. Your incompetence continues. That's what essentially this is doing. And that's what, in fact, I so wish you watched what happened yesterday. That's what, in fact, the incompetence that Transnet is now riding on. National Treasury allowed us to do this. But is there improvement, both financially and organizationally? There's no improvement. Now the question is, what is it exactly that we are trying to cushion here? Because I still don't understand the application of this cushioning. What are we trying to cushion? If they are going to still disclose, but their disclosure is going to be removed in that particular year, yet it's their own doing. I don't know if I make sense. Okay. This year, I intend irregular spending. But next day is not going to form part of that. It must disclose this, so I will account for what is happening, what happened that day. Yet I'm the very same person who's responsible for the previous one. What are we trying to push it? That's where I don't get answer.
That's not
true.
Okay. Let me just ask. You are making a fundamental point which is important. And that point is, are you not providing a perverse best incentive for doing this? In the sense that you are encouraging people to do things which in fact under this thing. So, there's a really more things that always fire in there. You know, Transnet has since started. We've never been exposed to Transnet in the form of currency. We've not been informed. In the light of what is happening now, we're getting more and more exposed to Transnet in the form of currency, precisely because
of their financial position. So we always, I'm saying, I accept your point that we may have unintended consequences, our actions. And that's your fundamental argument, which I can't fault. That if the, our decision may have unintended consequences. But where we sit from a subject perspective, we're sitting and saying, how do we have Transnet to be able to get locomotives, to be able to do all sorts of things which are more costly to the economy than anything else? Just the coal line. The coal line is awesome. It has never been below 7 million in 1996. Now we're sitting at above the 50 and below. We see that fiscal implication. The mining council are saying to me that the revenue loss for us is about 50 billion. So it's a costly to the economy, Transnet. And for that reason, we've got to weigh all of these things. We come back on the technical aspect of this. I'm saying from your general perspective that it may have the unintended consequences. I say I accept that. It may have those unintended consequences. People say, okay, there's no incentive to perform and improve the performance of financial management, financial reporting. It's something we must look into. But we must also say, in such circumstances, we need to build in a reporting mechanism, if yes, so that when there should be no cover, we must build in a reporting mechanism, and that reporting mechanism must also say what progress is being made by such institutions. So those are, I mean, we are also in a learning phase in some of these things. You got bewildered by saying, how do I solve this thing? In the process of thinking that you're solving, you achieve the unintended consequences. So, Transnet is a cost to this economy as we speak. It's a cost to the fiscal. So we may make rash decisions, but you must understand where we come from. I'm not saying it's an innocent decision, but the unintended consequences may happen if I'm not following, I'm not looking at them on a day-to-day basis as their performance financially. It may well be a better place to comment on that. If that's the case, we need to make serious intervention in order to change their conduct. It may well be, I'm not thinking about it, may well be, I'm not saying that's what we're going to do. It may well be, if they're not changing their conduct, then we may have to withdraw. I'm not saying we're going to do that. But it's quite important that they change conduct. If they don't change conduct, but what I'm saying is to accept our volunteer that it's not an intention to hide the and move forward if we do something like that, to build the reporting mechanism which will be transparent to Parliament as well.
However, the last qualification you are making that you're not looking at the day to day. That should be, I thought it was going to come in because their last financial statement, annual report, has declared 5 billion more. And where now you are intending to make them competitive in the market, they have lost 5 billion. They are going to go bold in the name of this country and make a loss with that borrowing because organizationally and structurally, with their own leadership, they are not competent. So the cushion you are providing, or rather the mechanism or remedy you are providing, is not guided or guarded by the leadership the organization in any way possible. If you lose 5 billion, yet you have an intention to borrow because you have an exemption that makes you look like you're competent, well, now you're trying to make them competitive in the market so that they can borrow. Yet themselves, they are not in that list. That's why you have to balance the day-to-day, because if they lose 5 billion, they're going to go borrow that 5 billion. It's a bottomless pit, because organizationally, there's problems that exist, which leads to that irregular expenditure have not been fixed, and there is no intention of fixing it, because the leadership is not competent at all. There's no ability to take ESCOM or Transnet from its former glory days. And you are correctly saying you have never been exposed to boosting ESCOM financially, I mean Transnet financially. So that on its own should tell you, if you find an entity stable and on your arrival, the instability starts, you lose money, yet you want me to exempt you.
Allow me to respond to, but the quick question I want to check for, is whether their loss is through incompetence or the structural problem they've inherited from China, which has had serious implications on the performance of Transnet because of the battle with China. For some reason that this management has inherited that. But you can talk on the 5 billion losses. But there's that background which might have impacted on that performance. I don't know. You can check on the 5 billion.
Now before he comes in, FFF office management understand that even if you inherit, when you get appointed into any way, you come there with the awareness of what you are going to do. And you come there with a provision of solution. If you don't have solution, why occupy the position?
Thank you. To you, Chairperson. So the Transnet one, as I've indicated earlier, it is a difficult one. That exemption was granted in March 2022, so it's more than 12 months ago. What I'd like to say is that an exemption that was granted to Transnet will not solve all of Transnet's issues. It was really to give them some competitive advantage in the market, in light of market conditions. We're well aware that Transnet has historical problems. We've seen the financial statements. We've noted what they've presented. But the exemption wasn't meant, or will not cure all of the problems. It was really the exemption from reporting on one particular part in financial statements. What we tried to do in an attempt to ensure that there is transparency and accountability, in granting the exemption, there was a condition. And one of the conditions was that as you isolate and reinvest the surrender expenditure on the financial statements, and move into the annual report, they must request the auditor to perform what you call an audit system and agreed upon procedure audit. So while that irregular expenditure disclosure note is no longer in the financial statement but moving into the annual report, there is still a report from the auditor to the board and to management on the state of affairs around that irregular expenditure note. That report will be presented to the board, and the board then will have to take the necessary actions to to ensure that the collective action is taken. Where there may be a gap, the minister has alluded to, is that the reporting into the oversight structures like Parliament and COPA as well. And that's something we could consider and see how from their report that information can be elevated so that from an oversight perspective they still adequate oversight. We've been in engagements with we've had a session with them in the last 3 to 4 weeks around some of the procurement issues, and we know that it's a very tough environment. But I think in trying to sort of conclude on such a one from our side, that extension was just to give Transnet some advantage in the market in terms of how the market considers and conceives this concept of irregular danger. However, that will not solve all of its problems, and that's the fully aware of.
Now, I agree with you. There is no parallel from what you try to do and what you try to achieve with the existing structure in the organization. And it's in relation with the exemption. So if you can, what is a remedy that you are producing, you are providing to give a different outcome. Yet the incumbent has no ability to deliver that. It's fruitless. And how do you measure the two and draw those parallels in the day-to-day? And the day-to-day that we have right now is that already they are in a 5 billion loss. And the 5 billion loss that comes from the nucleus of Transnet, which is the freight rail and the engineering, which has gone down. So if you compare the two, they are not answering whatever result you were trying to achieve with the exemption. Am I correct?
Chair, I can't disagree with you.
There's a danger in this note 4, which is coming. So if you read all of it on the page 22, there is one, I think it's bullet number 3, and then bullet number 4. Bullet number 4 is recurring qualification audit opinion. And you're trying to circumvent whatever it is on the recurring qualification. And if they're recurring from the similar people, how is it that going to help them when they cannot produce a different result in office? It can. And then and on number 2, all of it, or I mean on bullet 3, when you can produce with balance sheet, poor financial performance, inability of SOEs to refinance the existing debt. If you want to refinance, yet you can't produce a balance sheet, it's incompatible. Because the two should speak to each other. If you can't perform financially, you should have listened to the, I don't know if it was a CFO or someone standing in for CFO, reporting out from Transnet, and you look at the financials of ESCOM, the only person who always comes to the rescue of the SOE, and when you get a clear picture, is the auditor general. Not even internally, they pick up what's happening. Those quarterly reports, they have never given us anything until the auditor general comes to play and tells us, this is the actual clear picture of the institution that it informs Parliament and then it informs me. Are we going to apply this note for EFCON, for Transnet? Yes, they are currency in terms of officials and individuals that are holding office. They are not competent to carry what we are trying to do. Are we going to continue doing it?
I think it will, and let me try and help you here, because I think the courage you must provide is that the Transnet exemption is pre-disposed. So you are explaining the Transnet exemption in the context of this, whether this comes after, if I'm correct, right? So I think separate between that. This is a new dispensation. So explain the Transnet matters in their own context and the new dispensation in its own context. Otherwise, you're going to have the outlook that the members have. So I hope that rescues you.
Thank you, Chair. I agree, it's two separate matters. The Transnet exemption is something that's granted under a very separate section of the PMA, section 92. Instruction note 4 deals with, has a very different policy intention, and that is to introduce a compliance framework or compliance report as part of the annual report. So instruction 4 will still apply to all state institutions, which is national departments, provincial departments, public entities. The exemption for Transnet is a very specific exemption granted under section 92, and they've been granted an exemption for a period of 3 years. That's something obviously the minister has granted, and the minister will continue to monitor to see if the effectiveness. I think that's the point the minister made to say that it's important that as we continue this journey, the principles, as you correctly outlined, Honourable Member, is that is it effective? Is it achieving the outcomes that we sought to achieve when it was granted more than 12 months ago? And that's something we hear the point quite clearly. It's something that we can't disagree on, and I think your point is well noted.
We have answered that one of Transnet, and I said that or exemption of Transnet is not far from what you are presenting. And then I went on to read on different bullets of this, that if you are cushioning the failure to keep financial records in place, you can't produce quality financial statements, you can't financially, you cannot do anything right. Yet, these same people are trying to cushion them and give them a leeway to not a qualified audit so that they can come. They are incompetent in their own right. But when you are saying they are competent, that's what you want to achieve by this. How do you then distinguish the two? Because there's no parallel in what you want to achieve and what exists in our department.
To you, Chair, that bullet point was thought to explain that the challenges in some of these organizations are broader than what the exemption has provided. It's broader than some of the procurement challenges we have seen. The issues of governance, weak balance sheets, we said that the inability to raise capital in the market, they're requiring guarantees from the fiscus. It's much bigger and broader than a reporting exemption granted under the TFD. And we are, in this bullet, we are acknowledging that the challenges facing some of the SOEs are much bigger, much more broader, and requires many different instruments and interventions to resolve some of these. But from a treasury perspective, our core mandate and within the team of the Accountant General is really to focus on how do we achieve the accounting requirements in a manner that still promotes transparency, hold transparent accountable in that regard. And that's really the essence of what we are trying to unpack in that particular slide.
Now, I think Section 2% of the Constitution under Treasury Control will help us, because what I'm trying to drive is that this mechanism we are trying to provide is managing the situation and making people competitive for the market and for them to have a better financial outcome after being audited is not going to help the situation we are in, because the people who are holding office and ought to implement the cushion. And hear me out. Treasury, in trying to find the remedy in the current situation, is something that we require. We require a different remedy. Because we can't have ESCOM that is gone every 10 hours a day. We require a different set of rules, because if there's an explosion and they have to wait for 5 days for someone to approve a procurement when the whole country is in darkness, there must be a way we can circumvent that. But there are things that we must just move to. We don't want the trust on the road. And that's what you were looking at when you tried to say, as Transnet, try and do something else. But the problem is, are the people holding office capable of doing it? And on the day-to-day, are you satisfied with it? No, you're not. So with this note, we're not going to achieve that which you are trying to drive. This note is actually saying the incompetency must continue. For me, I don't get the alarm. I'm not seeing the achievement. Because the achievement is actually plunging the entire country into the further debt. Because they're going to borrow, and on our behalf, we are going to put the bid. We can't borrow anything because our borrowing has skyrocketed everywhere. So I don't see the balance check. And I don't think that requires an answer. There is no balance to the two. Our balance sheet in terms of debt is already here. And we say they must go and borrow, but themselves, they can't do anything. I would hear if ever we're being told specifics like ESCOM. There are things with ESCOM that we want to exempt in order for them to be able to keep the lights on. And this is what must happen. This is how we're going to monitor it. But this blanket approach is not working. Thank you.
Honorable Fat, I will shoot.
I think that's welcome, General. On these methods. I'm sure this is one of the notes first time when you are trying to produce this kind of approach. My main worry, as it has been with Mr. Bias's concern, was probably turning towards delegitimizing the theater. as I look into it, in terms of the detail which has been provided, the outlook is the outlook which can formulate an accounting creating firm accountability on those who are current and which the accounting officers have taken, rather some away from the executive authorities. The questions that have led to limitations though might be questions that we would like to see part of such a trend which you are trying to set. That the failure though of dealing with these things based on CFMA, what would they require those accounting officers and their failure that might have been. As it is the case, if you look into matters that lead to the exemption by that door, the question goes straight to Treasury. That I think the minister outlined such by making reference to the failure to set some kind of a pervasive incentive, which is going to assist people to move away from such. And my view is that your view of the legislation would assist more than anything, because the possibilities of accounting office are fair. And if you would want to enforce such responsibilities, then the areas that require them to stand firm on such, it would be assisting Treasury going forward. Where I had a problem, serious problem, was on the when you give that responsibility as far as deviation or concern to various entities, when you have known, we have seen through experience that even when it was in your hands, there was a lot of abuse, lot of failure from entities, and the spiraling of irregular expenditure, which arose specifically around that sector. How then would that be if the full responsibility is only left with the accounting office? I see that you find that you set up there in terms of some form of limitations of finalizing such decision. But that itself, without assessing who should benefit out of this. So I would have thought that would have made an assessment which would then throw this kind of a reporting lines, a note on quantifying institutions, which would be fairly in the standard of operation, which is far less on a risk than would have been to the entity that was you see, whether you're talking about ESCO, whether we are talking about what has happened into various SOEs in terms of exposure and less observation of such a myriad of such applications to yourselves before this note 4. So such kind of a scenario, I thought that would have allowed you to say then those who are performing better in these instances are given a way to operate in a sense which you have described in terms of no form. So it should not be a blanket, you see, paper thrown to the faces of all accounting officers. You know the problems that you face in terms of the spiral of irregular expenditure. and therefore how you want to invest it in your life. So it could be used itself as an incentive in terms of aligning performance, accountability, and some form of closer, what could I say, quasi-independent operational line in as far as accountability is concerned. What is your view?
That's an extremely important point. In fact, it's something that within the Treasury as officials we're having discussions on. It's really around, as we review the legislation and bring about these reforms, what would be the best model that will enable the state to move, to be a lot more effective, to be a lot more efficient, but at the same time give also accounting officers the ability to run the affairs of their business. So we've noted, and I think there are some learnings from the past, as you alluded to. The intention of the PSMA was always to allow accounting officers the space to determine what's right for their organization. And in that space, the ability to take decisions so that it's in the best interest of the organization, but at the end of the day, use the reporting framework for them to be held accountable and for them to be transparent in how they conduct their business. The deviations, as you correctly said, it was decentralized at some point, and then when there was the event of corruption and maladministration, Treasury took the decision at that point to centralize the decision making of all deviations. Obviously that slowed the business of these entities in the sense that they had to wait for Treasury to consider and approve these deviations. Treasury has now taken the decision to decentralize it. As per the original intention of the PFMA, which is to grant these accounting officers and authorities the ability to take these decisions. What we have seen, we engaged a number of different departments, accounting officers, and what we also do see is that a number of accounting officers have become very, risk averse. Is that because they are so afraid that by taking a decision and any connotation of any irregular expenditure that's attached to that decision, it's actually slowing down the state. So it's a very tough balancing act, as you rightly said. But we want to instill that spirit in the PSMA, remove the risk averseness, but also don't unfairly penalize those accounting officers who have taken decisions that are in the best interest of those organizations. So it's about finding the right balance, and that conversation is happening currently within the Treasury. But as we bring that reform into Parliament, I think that conversation and communication will be very useful in finding the right model by ensuring accountability, transparency, but more importantly, don't unfairly penalize those accounting officers who might have frustrations that are taking the best interest of the organization.
No, I agree with you at that point, because it's good to allow authorities to grow, to move, and the move many times has some triplings, minor errors which occur through good intent
and such good intent should not necessarily, I see the statement here of the minister to that effect, that don't paralyze the state towards fear, you see, encourage people to work positively, and while they work positively, be inclined to accept the fact that there might be mistakes here and there, but while you somewhat allow such minor mistakes within the operational environment, deal permanently with areas that get into intentional malaise in terms of operational environment, legality, matters of corruption and so forth. So I agree with you 120%. That's not create an environment where the operator will irritate you and have their signature restrained basically for the fear that my signature in this instance might be in this kind of environment. Well, that might lead into a situation where, for example, a CFO would want to know everything from accountant, from this level and that level, and constraining the freedom which has been allowed in any level of operation in the frame of decision making. So that one, 100% with yourselves. That's your way of trying to manage these things should not somewhat create that fear while you deal with matters of intent to do harm, move towards maximum loss and so forth. So that balance ought to be kept quite well. So that your presentation should then allow that center. And because we're a regularized state environment within the constitutional aspect, those need to be defined. In terms of your rule book, you look into those minor steps which could be probably viewed differently into the major pitfalls within this. Because your role is to look into the budget to ensure that market money, the expense, is fairly handled in a very legal constrained frame, and money is not lost at any other way. So I'm aligning with the minister's statement that a paragraph in that regard. But then take that statement and present it on a more defined, you see, the aspect should be taken into those points, that this is three key points that would take them towards that. And so don't leave it to the statement only. It must then be your own responsibility as an accountant general to say, this is where we want to move, and therefore we want to take these instances as serious research as these minor areas which could be pardonable, but punishable in one way or another.
Mr. Treasurer?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think the Honourable members making quite a very useful recommendation. We've taken note of it, and obviously as a team and the drafters of the reform, we will definitely take that principle into account, because it's quite important. As we move forward, as the Office of the Accountant General, our primary mandate is norms and standards, and to ensure that as we provide a framework for financial reporting, it does give accounting officers the ability to make decisions that are in the best interest of the state. But as you said as well, it's that fine balancing act, because you also need to ensure that there are consequences if you do break the law, and so forth. But that request, that recommendation is noted, and we made us a note of it as well. Thank you so much.
Chair, I'm covered. I know I'm trying to avoid tautology. Most of my questions have been covered. But I just had a concern on the first bullet on slide 23. In essence, you are saying the state-owned entities are over-regulated. And that poses a challenge in the current legislation. And those regulations were passed by this current government. We should look into ways and means of controlling that legislation so that we are in line with IFRS. Is that what you are saying? Because that was going to be my question to the minister.
On my way from the airport this morning, I was telling you that slide 22 is problematic.
I've never had that kind of honesty in a while, eh? Or transparency.
Yeah.
So very good.
It was really delayed. The real reason why we're here is to speak about instruction 4. But it's important. I mean, these conversations also help us as we think about some of the reforms and as we take some of these forward as well. The reporting requirements. So obviously when we met with Transnet, Eskom, all of them have relayed a concern that the requirements are already onerous in the sense that by law they have to report under the International Financial Reporting Standards, so the entire financial framework has to align with that. They also got for the debt that's listed under the JSC, they've got reporting requirements on that. The PFA really brings two additional areas which is under Section 55 around the reporting of irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, and losses through criminal conduct. And really that's what they pose to us, to say these requirements over and above are quite onerous. Because internationally, in terms of best practice, all other state institutions only report under it. What we also picked up in our discussions with the ratings agencies that other jurisdictions don't have the reporting requirements. So see, as you're looking at a reform, how do you take such matters which are important in the practical context but shouldn't unfairly or negatively impact on audit outcomes? And that's a very tough and delicate conversation, as the Honourable Member like the question with me this morning. I mean, it's a very, very difficult one because, as you've seen, the consequences sometimes out of these decisions could be quite pervasive. So it's a conversation, and I think your assessment is correct, and it's something that we need to consider as a National Treasury: what is the right framework? In terms of allowing SOEs to report on, but ensuring that there's still accountability and transparency in that reporting framework.
I would love a situation where the conversation would be turned into action. We are still in conversation,
When I send accidents back and forth, I feel that you remedy the situation. Sometimes when things are in the pipeline, one don't get to understand how long the pipe.
Maybe if I allow my colleague here, the process is quite advanced, but she'll unpack where we are,
yeah.
And where, at what point we introduce it into cabinet and possibly parliament as well.
How do you that?
No micromanagement. You're using your shop steward voice.
Thank you so much. So I will address the question of the legislative reforms, but before getting into the legislative reforms, the PSMA, I want to get into instruction 4 and really align it to the PSMA to say what was the really the intention of the instruction 4. And I'll give you a little bit of an history. So there is the PSMA, which is in section 46, section 55, it says you must disclose in the financial statement what has occurred in that financial year. It doesn't say what was in the previous financial year. It doesn't say what was there 5 years ago or 8 years ago. Now, how do we now see all these issues of historical irregular expenditure finding itself in the financial statement? It's the framework, the instructions that were issued over the year. And it created problems for certain institutions to say, we don't have capacity, number one, to look at historical and also identify current and disclose it. It's costly also, because sometimes we have to get external people to assist us. And then we were trying to see how best we can assist institutions to deal with historical is very important, because we think that historical is a big expenditure. So there could be fraudulent criminal transactions. There could be just normal non-compliance. We wanted all of this information to be reported, but trying to align with the ethos of the PSMA. So we said we will keep the disclosure in the financial statement and any other details of irregular expenditure around the assessment, determination, and all of those things, it should be recorded in the annual report of the institution. And I should say, if you look at the IFRS standards, there is a clause that talks to impracticability judgment, because if you cannot quantify a certain amount, you can disclose in your financial statement as a narrative to say, this is impractical to disclose. And I see that as a blanket, it's like a blanket exemption. There's no alternative for you need to do. You can't disclose. If you just say, I'm unable to do it, it allows you to do that. But the PSMA doesn't allow that. And these SOEs, they use IFRS, they use the PSMA. So we're trying to, instruction 4 is trying to create the synergy to ensure that there is no such thing as blanket disclosures in the financial statement. So with the PSMA reform, number one, we have looked at the definition of irregular expenditure and put that in irregular expenditure to look more on financial losses and also to look at criminal aspects, fraudulent aspects of it as well. And just say this is just non-compliance, but it does not have a lot, it does not have criminal aspects attached to it. So we have put them into those different categories. So we have done the review. It has been submitted to our legal department just to see if everything is aligned with the legislative framework, what is allowable, what is not allowable. So in fact, we are meeting tomorrow for the entire legal review of the PSMA. And yes, that's basically what I wanted to say.
Can you see what the treasury issues?
Okay. So we've also we deal also with the treasury regulations review. So and the reason of the review of the treasury regulations is, remember, the treasury regulations implements the PSMA. But over the years, there were such a number of instructions that they issued. And I mean, as a CFO, just to keep track of all those instructions, there is no way you will lose track and you will have non-compliance, you will have irregular expenditure. So we took all those instructions, review them, see what is legal in nature for it to be elevated into the treasury regulations. And anything else that is not really seen as legal to be included rather as guidelines. And we decided, because if you look at the treasury regulations, this paragraph, section 1.2.1, it says applicability. And sometimes it gets very confusing. Like treasury regulations 9 applies only to departments and constitutional institutions. It's a good section, but it doesn't apply to public entities. And one may wonder, okay, what should entities use? So usually you say, okay, they're supposed to have their own internal policy. But you see entities taking exact provisions that apply to departments and developing policies. So we've decided to develop treasury regulations for each category of institution, like for constitutional institutions and departments, and for Schedule 3A and 3B public entities, and for SOE. I think building that synergy in terms of reporting, looking at the IFRS, for SOE it will be different because we will have treasury regulations that apply to them. So we started with the consultation process internally, but the restructuring of the treasury instructions, treasury regulations and instructions have been conducted already. So I think we are, by November, because the treasury regulations, they follow a public comment process, we are hoping we will issue a set for public comment as well as those.
No, thank you. Having listened to your response and what we have raised here upon empathy, that it is clear that the instruction notes in the report is more like tightening the screws when it comes to reporting and compliance. So it's a very progressive instruction note. Now, in your review process, let's answer that. Would you still consider section 92 as an option, because from where I stand, section 92 is the complete opposite of the instruction number. Do you think it should remain as an option for state-owned entity to use when the circumstances according to them warrant them to involve that section? What would be the response in terms of that? Especially considering the fact that ESCOM attempted and we were very strong in opposition of such which goes to show on the lighter side of it that the deployment does work, because even the minister alluded to the fact that he deserves the policy to say he will find in economy our own society. Thank you.
So, I mean, section 92 as it currently stands gives the Minister of Finance the authority to grant sections. And that's currently the practice, has been the practice for a number of years. And obviously, in granting the exemption, we still need to ensure that some principles are still, some principles that are still brought forward, and there's alignment to those around accountability and transparency. We will engage our legal department on this particular one. Whilst we see so many requests coming through, I would still think it's quite an important enabler in the PFMA. But in doing so, whether there needs to be public consultation before the minister grants it, is possibly a stronger measure that we could introduce to show that we do take into account public comment before such a decision is taken. Obviously, we've learned through the ESCOM extension, and that public consultation was quite important, quite powerful in actually allowing the minister to take possibly the correct decision at the end of the day. So I would still see that as an important provision in the PSMA, but it's something that we could strengthen to ensure that we could strengthen the public consultation around that such a decision.
Differently put, I know it's the prerogative of the minister, but I'm sure he does consult with you in making the final decision. So, how many applications of Section 92 were received in recent past, and how many were rejected? I'm trying to gauge and assess the effectiveness of this section, whether or not it's justifiable, or it is trying to abuse the system and cover up certain aspects that have gone wrong within the system. In percentage, you have to give me the numbers. Just roughly, how many have you received and rejected?
It's just I think the process of exemption is decentralized, so there are exemptions coming from the procurement space. This particular one for Transnet and ESCOM is around the reporting, the accounting, which would, the accountant would look into. But then we cannot really at this juncture like provide a specific percentage, because we would have to collect information from the different divisions, because it's different exemptions. That you get the request that the minister receives from different institutions. The departures as well, but there's also a Section 79 departure litigation. So we speak lots of those as well, and majority of it would be departures from Treasury instructions that we should say, maybe give an example, we want to depart from cost containment measures because we want to lower the cost of something like that. So there are those, I call them exceptions. They're not supposed to be norms, exceptions. But then we do get, and we usually can submit
So in essence, other than Transnet, there are other state-owned entities that have been granted exemption under Section 92.
Correct. But not on Section 65, 40, on other matters.
It's not a lot. And then we can make a determination ourselves here on whether it's a lot or whether it calls for cost, because I think too open ended for such a serious matter.
Thank you. That will assist us in the review of legislation, just to holistically look in all the problematic sections so that we don't just do Thank you, Chair.
So what I want to know is, to me, this exemption is
kind of mechanisms that you guys want to utilize to cover up incompetences in your department, corruption and municipal funds. So what I want to know is, will then be all these disclosures be available or made available to the public and to Parliament?
National Treasury.
Thank you for the question, the Chairperson. My colleague, if you don't mind, can you please to pull up the core business case in the application for that exemption, and my colleague will just unpack some of that very quickly. But just to indicate that the exemption doesn't completely remove the disclosure of irregular expenditure. It moved it from the annual financial statement into the annual report. The annual report still has information around the irregular expenditure, the consequence management, steps taken around disciplinary reactions, and so forth. In addition to that, what we've asked as part of the conditions to the exemption, we've asked that they must do an agreed upon procedure audit to give some level of assurance to management and the board on the accuracy and the completeness of that. So that is there. So the general public still has a sense of the irregular expenditure and it's still contained in the annual report, but not always in the annual financial statement per se. The actual request from Transnet was really very specific to deal with certain aspects. And as the questions were coming, Monsignor was able to very quickly pull out some of the reasons. And I think that will give you a better sense of the Transnet request and what we were trying to achieve with that particular one.
Thank you, Chair. So with the Transnet exemption, there were quite a lot of issues around historical disclosure of irregular expenditure, and the reason why they wanted an exemption was to allow them to give them time to follow the process of the framework in terms of doing determination, and I think that is important, whether to identify within a particular transgression was there a financial loss, was there criminality. So they wanted to perform that exercise, and it goes as far back as 8 years, 29 years back. And within that process, they would still have to, obviously, there are instances where they would incur irregular expenditure in the current year, they still have to identify, follow the process, and report on it. So they've got, like, public entities are required to develop a materiality and significance framework. That's another thing I'll talk to, that the TFMA is quite different from the IFRS, the International Company Reporting Standards, because IFRS allows an institution to report up to a certain threshold, depending if you say my materiality is this much, and it's dependent on the use of the organization. And the TFMA does require that materiality be developed for decision making for the board of the entity. So with the regular expenditure, materiality does not apply to disclose everything, because there could be losses, there could be criminality within those transgressions. So then, in terms of their materiality threshold, they realize that procurement events that are less than 2 million, quite a lot of them, and they were unable to go in each and every transaction at that moment in time to report on them in the annual financial statement. Then, because they use IFRS, the impracticability judgment came into the discussion, and this discussion was had, we had it with the National Treasury Department and also the Auditor General. So we were trying to look at different alternatives to assist, but also ensuring that we maintain that spirit of accountability and transparency. Then the impracticability judgment came into play, and we said, okay, if you do say these transactions are impractical, it needs to be demonstrated. Firstly, on the capacity, secondly, on the constitution, give that demonstration and the auditors are comfortable with it, then you can use that clause in your financial statement. And obviously, we ended up where we looked at the request, where they sent a request on section 92 exemption. And obviously, there are certain criteria that we look at and how far back they need to report on certain information. We developed a template, a reporting template for Transnet to report on in the annual report. So we provided an alternative process rather than just saying this is a blanket exemption, don't disclose anything and walk away. We're still required to disclose all of that information in the annual report and make sure that it is clear and understood.
Guideline on unauthorized expenditure.
what instruction for that, because we realize that we were prescribing the same process in the system. We consolidated all of those requirements into one instruction. So I can't really say, Honorable Nadope, I did research best practice outside, but the reason for instruction four was based on experiences that we realized during the implementation phase of those guidelines and also the instructions that we issued and some of the challenges that we identified. If you can note previously, within the expenditure, PFMA is very broad and this is expenditure impaired in contravention of security expenditure. Meaning the entire amount is just disclosed in the financial statement. But there was no how part, like how do you go about doing so? So accounting officers, CFOs, when we have CFO forums, they will say, we need assistance, tell us what is that that we need to do. Number one, to identify what preventative measures do we need to do. That's when we develop that criteria around the assessment, because we do believe that there would be instances where someone may identify something to be regular expenditure, but if it's just through the tech, you find that it is not a regular expenditure. That is an assessment process. We also need at the stage, which is the determination stage, where financial losses need to be determined, criminal aspects needed to be identified within transactions and reported accordingly. And then there is like a formal probe into the matter, which are the investigations, which must happen in a case where there is criminality and so on and so forth. So I could say the research is based on the transversal matter that came through from some of the implementation challenges that were identified with the chief experience. Oh, okay. So in the report, there is a requirement for all institutions to record quarterly recovery on that registered software in the framework. Is that really the progress of whether the department is accounting or the accounting office that is in the way? What are the amounts in the process? What are the principles in the way? If you say internal control has been put in place, what are those internal controls that have been put in place? Because sometimes we go as far as asking them to, if they think that they have a policy, we can go back to the centralized system where it is that company is done.
What we have now, and it's not working because it is there, they must report quarterly, but they're not doing it. What I want to know is specifically, or do you think there is a capacity problem, or do they have the capability? I don't know, because there is, and we are still struggling with the monthly reporting, we're still struggling with the 30 months payments. The things are there. So that's why I'm asking, based on this, is there a specific more serious tool or coordination institution that will focus specifically on this? Because we do have, all of us agree, that it is there. And it's not working, or it is working, but there's something missing.
So the quarterly reporting does exist in the state, and generally that quarterly report focuses on performance information around strategic objectives and what entities have sort of agreed to do for a given financial year. What this quarterly report, as per instruction of 4, requires is much more detailed information around if it is an irregular transaction, what are the remedial steps that are required. And the reason why we require this is that it also enables us as the Treasury to determine whether need to go in and assist an organization. But where we also see that in our engagement there may be capacity gaps, it also then allows us to step in and provide some training around enhancing their supply chain management processes, etc. So that reporting requirement is much more detailed than the normal quarterly reporting, which is primarily focused on performance information at this stage. So it is a much more progressive requirement. And I think that as we move, this discussion is 6 months or 8 months old, it will allow us to see a lot more as we move forward. I'd also like to maybe just add, I mean, your question around the benchmark and where we would like to see this instruction note 4 evolve into is a compliant report in the annual report, a fully blown, because there are many aspects around compliance which we do not see in an annual report. And it almost aligns to how the Auditor General's reporting framework is as well. I mean, the Auditor General provides an opinion on the annual financial statement. And we do have an annual financial statement in the annual report. We do have a performance report in the annual report, and the Auditor General also provides findings on that area. And the last area the Auditor General reports normally is compliance and compliance legislation. So this compliance report will also then enable and align to how the Auditor General would, as part of their mandate, and this then strengthens that as well to ensure that they, from an oversight perspective, it also allows them to be able to audit that compliance report. So that's where we see and what we envisage that this compliance report will be evolving to.
My point is that I'm not even with the reporting requirement. Yes, it is there, but there's no report. Because, just to make an example out of this situation, if you look, for example, at a conditional grant, no? Then you must report on the different phases. No? Why is it that only after the financial year, Treasury is discovering that this fund was not spending for that? Because there's no reporting at all. And it's a concern for me, because as government, we're trying to monitor, to legislate, to do something, but the monitoring. So I'm not with the monitoring yet or the progressive reporting. I'm with the monitoring for the first report. Because in some instances, I'm not saying all over, we did not even get the report. So what I'm asking is, what will be different now from what was happening in the past? Is there a specific tool?
Right. So what is introduced in terms of monitoring. For example, in the municipal space, we've automated the audit action plan. So that comes now online. So we have much more better visibility of those and line of sight. And where it requires intervention, we then proceed. The question of monitoring is a very important one. There are various areas within the Treasury that does this. So in the spending conditional grant, that our public finance team will oversee that process. The one that's before us, our instruction 4, that quarterly report is managed within the OAG, the Accountant General's office. And the reason why we've centralized that process is that within our office, we also do have a capacity building unit. So when we see instances of continuous transgression, and once we're able to understand what leads to those transgressions, we can then get our capacity building team to then assist with some reforms in some areas of intervention in that space.
So this particular one is centralized in the Accountant General's office to allow us the visibility on what is required, of each patient that are required.
Yeah, Chair, in closing, just to say that yesterday at Transnet, there was a remedial action plan to address internal control deficiencies, and it was not effective. And just to say that on the action plan, so I don't need to answer on that one, but I just want to ask you to please look into the monitoring and get a tool to monitor the effectiveness of this intervention. Thank you, Chair.
I need to close. I need to conclude. I just also a few questions on the list. Please, can we get the full set of questions from members? We should have about now. So, two questions, one room and your questions, and then that's
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just very quickly then, in terms of a request, first of all, Honourable Khateba has requested details on Section 92 exemption. And can I then ask also for a copy of the currently in place exemption granted to France, actual exemption and the application from France, so we can get to understand that one better. And then, Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, I can be corrected, the Transnet was faced with a covenant default in July of 2022, and the exemption was granted in March 2022. Was that exemption then granted to Transnet in an effort to give them cover to be able to refinance the $1 billion loan that was due in July?
Thank you very much, Chair. Covered by Malangane in terms of the process of Transnet. It's very interesting. And coupled with that, or in addition with that, can we have a clear monitoring process of both the notebook and the Section 92? But there is one thing that came up from the implementation of the need for under liability and law. You are saying if the amount of a loss is irrecoverable, a loss caused by people who could not prepare proper financial services, the accounting office of the department or constitutional association may write it off using the law in place for a write-off. And note for them allows them to do the write-off. What is then now a process that is going to ensure that a certain transaction that is picked up has someone accounting for it? Because we cannot at this juncture say irrecoverable and then just put it no follow the process. There must be a mechanism in which the irrecoverable was first treated. And if we are going to use the note for to make the business of the state in line with the, if I may say, private business, where there isn't so many heavy laws that are governing and regulating it. What is this mechanism which is in place to make sure that there is a level of accountability for the condition?
Thank you very much. One area for me is the area of interest, which one supports the rationale. On getting into all these bits and pieces in terms of your instruction notes, beginning to rationalize everything and things like that. I really support that kind of scenario, because you're not going to run around telling for this file and that file and admitting some directives. But the same environment which I talked about on the basis of the PFMA, it's a same and equal environment which is facing MFMA. You see, I'm just for interest sake, I know on procurement, method of procurement, we have a similar terrain where you create your defines and nodes for everybody. Everybody. You see? And why is it not the case when you follow the trend overall? Because treasury trend in all these kinds of spheres. And the parameters of the state expenditure, the effectiveness and all that stuff. And why the rationalization does not permit that sort of a environment. I know section 176 of MFMA might work in line with what you see in terms of PFMA. And as an accountant general, your determination of certification of standards would benefit the audit process, would benefit the accountability process, and therefore align those methods of a clean administration as far as financial management is concerned. So in this instance, as we are talking now, do you foresee, or may you look into that kind of rationalization space, which could take care of such instances of accountability without segregating the aspects that relate to all spheres of government? Because PFMA gets into the problem international, and the MFMA deals with the so the review process can take that process down to what you see is facing government at the provincial and national level is even more pervasive when it relates to municipal functionality, their own accountability, the financial management aspect of making the work of the Auditor General easier than those who meet up on the big standards. They give it more easier in terms of reference based on the rules which are instructing on those kinds of tools.
Right. Thank you very much. Alright, Accountant General, I think what the principle is good, wherein you are trying to create business agility. That's been an outlook that has been held for quite some time, that the SOEs have been able to compete competitively with, you know, their rivalries and so on, and competitors. So that business agility is important, that on one hand they've got a national interest, on the other hand they've got a business obligation, because bailouts are not a sustainable or desirable business model. So that principle I think is well captured, right? That there is a need to allow for, and you cited irregular expenditure, for example, is one item which is somewhat unique to South Africa, right? That's the problem. But it's still a South African reality, and therefore one which must still find expression in the South African process. So what I gather is that you are moving irregular expenditure from the financial statement to what you call legislation compliance. Another section for reporting.
Right?
For reporting on irregular expenditure that occurred during the financial year. It has to be accumulative. It can't be isolated. We'll report on this year only. We have to get the full picture. Because the irregular expenditure still remains irregular expenditure. So whilst you may be housing it in a different section of the reporting, I don't think we should dumb it down to isolating it just to income. So we do want, because the corrective action steps that come with irregularity still apply. They still have to be so there has to be a deliberate effort to ensure that the corrective measures, including consequence management, are followed. In 2 weeks' time, we're going to be dealing with the unauthorized expenditure here of about 10, 12 departments, right? And some of it is very old, so it can't be lost in the reporting. And I get a sense that this new arrangement is problematic if it is going to isolate just within the year. So it's presented. That's the second point that I want to draw your attention. The third point is the prerogative or the right to issue instruction notes is not a blank check to really just lead through the back door. And I think National Treasury must be very guarded to the extent to which it issues Treasury instruction notes and the implication that they have to the established principles of legislation. Because you can't alter the legislation even without parliamentary process, outside public consultation, on the basis that you've got the right or prerogative or the power to issue an instruction note. Because this instruction note changes fundamentally reporting. It's not an operational matter like you did with instruction note 3 insofar as dealing with expansions and deviations. That's a process matter. Here you are altering at a very fundamental level, an extreme level, the reporting processes and the consequences thereof, insofar as we have established them in South Africa as a standard. So I don't think there's a need to go back, notwithstanding the principles, to review and rework the implementation processes and projects. Because yes, where there's legislative reforms, then bring them properly through the parliamentary process, not through our treasury. It's a slippery slope. And I think in the context of a country struggling with governance matters and in SOEs,
there should not be an easy way out for those SOEs. A higher burden of rest with all of us for the purposes of oversight and accountability. Because whilst the Transnet thing that was saying earlier to you, Transnet exemption is pre instruction, a lot of song and dance was made yesterday about it and how it modified the audit outcome. It was as if it was a success.
Yes.
We changed the, we got an improved audit outcome. But on close inspection, it only arises because there was this conduit which arose out of an exemption. So I think the other consideration to make is the impact that instruction will have on the outcomes as a reporting standard. I think it's important. So I don't think any of us here are adverse to creating an environment for SOEs to be able to function optimally. But that functionality must run parallel with ensuring oversight, accountability, and good governance standards remain in place. So I just thought I should underscore that one very profoundly, that instruction notes must not be a second set of legislation which has not gone through a particular due process of consultative checks and balances, including but not limited to other. Because the inverse of it could very well be that exemptions of this nature must be a parliamentary responsibility, whether they reside with the Standing Committee on Finance or Appropriations, or ourselves, there is a modality that could be worked out. Simply because of the fundamental consequences they have to the state of things. So I think please respond to the questions that members have posed and the requests that members have asked for insofar as submission is concerned. Today is Wednesday, next week Friday, close of business and all these other issues. So really, I think, go back. The principle is established. I think it's the modalities and the practical implementation. And as you said, slide 22 does give a new purview to this on the challenges. But what we cannot do is we can't legislate through the backdoor of accounting channel. I think that would be very dangerous precedent. Yes, benchmark with international standards and where re-standardization has to take place, then do that. But let's open up the process a bit. And I think there's valuable lessons and conclusions you learned out of the ESCOM application for exemption. And the fact that it resulted in the National Treasury and the Minister not granting that exemption should in itself tell you that a lot more work has to go into this. Because we must not deal with these things in a piecemeal approach. The ESCOM one has set a benchmark, and I think everybody must be learning to it. And finally, I think the Minister made a point earlier on about the operations at Transnet and whether they have a material impact on the government. And you see, Transnet moved from a 5 billion rands profit to a 5 billion rands loss in 1 year. And they don't cite governance as the reason for that. They cite manganese exports and transportation, a drop in that, and therefore having suffering in the loss of 5 billion because the value at which they were transporting is 5 billion. So I think any exemption must run parallel to performance as well. So I just wanted to remind us that I asked the question yesterday in this report. So I think we will go back, reflect, review, rework, this particular one and open up to the consultation and parliamentary process, and then bring a full set of amendments to the PFA Parliament, because the risk you run is to be a player in the referee. And I don't think that we have, where today you are exempting, then tomorrow the consequences of an exemption that you would have granted comes back requiring financial injection. And then the entity is saying, well, you know. So I think protect yourselves as well in the interest of the
Thank you, Chairperson, and to the Honourable members for those questions. Chair, if I can maybe pick up on the point you made around the instructions and legislating through the instruction process. It's something that we are very mindful of, and obviously being relatively new in this office, it's something that we will take forward. One of the key things is that as we review the Treasury regulations, we want to streamline the instructions that are currently in existence. We've done a count. It's actually close to 100 instructions issued over a period of maybe 15 straight years. And we do understand it is problematic to have such a high number of instructions of legislating this very important environment of public finance. And as we look at the reform, we want to remove those instructions. Those elements of the instruction that are relevant will go to the Treasury regulations, which will, for us, will follow a process of proper consultation so that we get the best outcome that may be desired. Instructions going forward, Chair, I note the point. It's something that we need to strengthen. We have too many instructions currently in existence, and it's not ideal for the Treasury, it's not ideal for entities to have so many instructions, because it just attracts much more unwarranted expenditure and obviously irregular expenditure. So Chair, that point around that is well taken and something that we will address. Chair, some of the requests from the honourable members we will provide. The question around the $1 billion debt, I don't have that information out there, but it's something we will, our assets and liabilities team would have dealt with the transaction at that particular point in time. I don't think the Office of the Accountant would have dealt with it, but I think the point that you've raised around the timing of the exemption and that refinancing of the $1 billion is something that we will have to look into. The point around the monitoring processes of instruction note 4 and section 92, for me that's something we'll take back. There was a question around the losses, the recovery of losses, and the point around liability in law. Instruction note 4 doesn't bring in any new requirements that are currently in place. If you look at the PFMA in the Treasury regulations, it's quite clear that all accounting officers must take every step possible to recover debt that is due to them. Currently the process that's in place is that there is an internal loss control function that will raise the debt and also attempt to recover it. In instances where they are unable to, they will then seek the assistance of the state attorney, and then they will follow a legal process. And that legal process will then inform the recoverability of the debt or not. Generally, the state attorney's office got quite a good process, because they deal with not just in the entire state debt on the Ricardo Politics side, and that current process is currently in place, and I would almost say entrenched in the current systems of government.
Honourable Sylvia, the point you raised around the MMA and the rationalisation, hoping I got the question correctly, I'm hoping the question is not that we rationalise the MFMA into the PFMA, but rather have two separate pieces of legislation. And I'll tell you the reason why. The MFMA goes into a lot more detail in terms of the legal requirements. And obviously in the MFMA space, you've got many different pieces of legislation that manages the financial performance or financial management. You've got the Systems Act, the Property Rates Act, as well as the MFMA. And what's quite key is that in the municipal space, because it's linked very closely to services and the objectives, we see many requests coming to the National Treasury in which municipalities need to consult the Treasury on various aspects of service delivery, whether it's entering into contracts longer than 5 years, whether it's to lease a property to a private sector company, but to truly seek our comment on various aspects. But what's quite key to the MFMA and what's sort of enshrined in that piece of legislation is that there's much greater public consultation with communities around what they do. So any new intervention, any new objective that they bring into the municipality, they need to consult with the community, with the provincial treasury as well as the national treasury. And we see that is quite a good process, quite a good system in which we are able to then put a comment on aspects of service. Obviously, from a legal perspective, the PFMA is really giving the county officer a lot more power and authority to deal with transactions within their business domain. From an accounting perspective, municipalities have already migrated to GRAP, SA GRAP. And where we would like to see is when we have a common accounting to also move towards an accrual basis, which then would enable us to consolidate the accounts for national government a lot more simply. And that's a process that has been embarked on. And the key to unlocking that process is the finalization of the IFMS system. Chair, do know we will be here next week to present on IFMS. And that common accounting framework will really put us in a much better position from a consolidation point of view. It will give us much more visibility across all different accounts, but it will also give us much greater and much richer insights into the financial data of government by having one common accounting framework across government. The point, Chair, I think around consequence management and really instruction note 4. From an accounting perspective, and that's where the difficulty came in, we have the requirements of the PFMA to say all your regular expenditure occurred in a particular financial year must be disclosed. And we look at the accounting framework as well. What the accounting framework says is that there's an accounting term, but really all expenditure that accounted for expense and must be recognized in that financial year
So there can't be any mismatch of expenditure in terms of bringing in pastures expenditure into the Commonwealth. We do know that there is a level of accountability that bringing in past expenditure that possibly not condoned, possibly in this space, it may enhance the accountability process. We need to find a mechanism that still ensures that. And I think the point you're raising is accountability and consequence management cannot be diluted through instruction before or any similar instruction. That has to remain. And the difficulty sometimes is finding that balance. Because you always, from an accounting perspective, you want to ensure that all expenditure is recognized in that particular year. And similarly, all transgressions when it comes to irregular expenditure, future and irregular expenditure, also accounted for in that particular year. So as we move forward, Chair, we will have to see how we as the Treasury and as the Office of the Counsel General find that right spot in terms of bringing these reforms, ensuring that from an accounting perspective we still align to the accounting sector, but issues of consequence management, accountability is not diluted through this process. So Chair, that's something we will look at into as part of the reform. Chair, I'm hoping I've covered all the questions, but if there is something we haven't, we will provide it as part of the written response as well.
Thank you very much. I really assumed there would be a short meeting and I wanted to sneak in when it's time. Okay, that won't happen.
It won't happen.
Let me take this opportunity to thank you, colleague, Accountant General, Chief Director and team. From National Treasury, and convey our thanks to the Minister as well for being here this morning, and I'm sure you'll give us the feedback on how the conversation has progressed. We will see you next week, Wednesday, on reporting on the IFMS. The SIU will also be reporting on some aspects of IFMS, which let's have finish.
Chairman,
did
you get
that sentence? After a long time. And then colleagues...
Not to mention the media in that corner, though.
Colleagues, one final issue. On the 19th and 20th, we are dealing with unauthorized expenditure. So it's over 2 days, and we already had a briefing from National Treasury. Logistically, to bring down all those departments here may be problematic because we've got short meeting time packed into the morning sessions because afternoon sessions. So what we will probably experiment is for us to have access to M46 and the mutual capabilities and then line up each department. Our request is this, colleagues. What we need to do is make a determination at the end of each submission by a department of whether we authorize or not and where that money will come from. So either from the consolidated fund or from the baseline budget over the MTF of the department. So it's COCTA, GCIS, DPSA, State South Africa, Department of Higher Education, I think, Social Development, and the Department of Women. Right? So National Treasury has made suggestions and recommendations. We are not bound by those. So can I request that you prepare so that we can go through each one of these quickly, because they may have an impact on the MTVBS. So that's why we have to finalize this at the end of September. Even if the report doesn't serve before the House then, but it is for National Treasury to know the decisions we have taken ahead of that budget. So can we please conclude on the unauthorized expenditure schedule on the 19th and 20th, and because Treasury has briefed us, if it is possible to apply for us to be exempted from the House to stretch the committee sittings, because it's lots of departments, and I know, for example, the one on the road, on Department of Transport is very complex because it's the Road Traffic Management Corporation and all sorts of moving parts. So some discussions will be protracted, some will be short. So I plead colleagues that you apply your mind and put time. And if we can be able to have that exemption to the House, that's the only Parliament goes to recess on the 22nd. So we've got that momentum.
Chair, I wanted to propose that instead of us having some people on the screen and some here because we want to deal with it, isn't it possible for us to go to them so that we also cut the expenditure of bringing all the departments? I hear all of them stay in Pretoria. Why don't we go to them in Pretoria and line them up and deal with them? So that we don't have excuses of people that load shedding, I can't hear you. And that time we need the accountability, because that one of approving an unauthorized expenditure and all those things requires all of us to have an understanding and a discussion there and explanation of many things. But if we're going to do it hush-hush, like we're rushing for this and that, it's not going to work.
All right, we will look at the best cost-effective option available. We must worry about that. All right, so we but colleagues, either way, the bottom line is, Treasury has briefed us, can you please prepare? I think that is the worst decision that I've got. Lunch will be served downstairs, meeting till the giant. See you next week.
Thank you.
You are all invited. If you don't go, food. I want you to food less expensive.
I know. You see, I reckon.
I only have one way to